let's take a look at how science is portrayed in the movies. It seems like science nerds love nothing more than to point out inaccuracies. In Interstellar, Matthew McConaughey probably wouldn't survive a leap into a black hole. In the Titanic, the freezing lovebirds were floating under the wrong sky. Neil deGrasse Tyson was all over that one. Reporter Todd Bookman has been digging into one scientifically inaccurate plotline that pops up again and again.
For lack of a better term, we're going to call it the double conk. It goes something like this.
You know, where you get conked on the head and then lose your memory and then maybe get conked on the head or have some kind of emotional jolt to bring you back.
This is Mary Spires. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and a professor at Drexel University. She also happens to run a website called neurosci-fi.com, where she and her students blog about how brain science and conditions like autism or dementia are depicted in movies. The double conk is something that she's seen again and again on screen. The first blow makes the character forget who they are or where they're from. Then the second blow, or maybe a familiar song or photograph, snaps it all back into place.
Well, you took a pretty good knock on the head. No doubt about that. Good news is, you'll live.
The double conk shapes the story arc for the 2001 film The Majestic, starring Jim Carrey.
It used to mean so much. It doesn't. Can it? Harry, I don't even know who I am.
Believe me, it's okay if you've never seen it. It's also the plot for the 1956 film Singing in the Dark.
My name is... I don't know. I don't know.
Double conk amnesia shows up in an early Tarzan movie and a Tom and Jerry feature. It's portrayed several times in silent films. And of course, it's all over sitcoms and cartoons.
When Fred opens a door, kaboink! The rock lands right on his noggin.
I suppose it has to be done, but is it necessary to use such a hard rock?
Frederick has a hard head, you know.
Clearly, somewhere, there is a studio executive who really likes this idea. But Spires was like, wait, what?
It's really neurologically bizarre. And so I wondered really where it started, where it came from.
So she starts digging back to find the origin of the double conk. And it isn't just on screen. It shows up in plots written just after the Civil War and in Victorian era stories. And then she wonders,
was this just in the minds of fiction writers? And I found out, no, it wasn't.
She keeps searching and eventually traces it back not to a writer or a novelist, but to a doctor.
So there was a man in the early 1800s. His name was Bichat, a French doctor.
Full name, Marie-François Xavier Bichat. He's an anatomist and a surgeon. In portraits, he's a handsome-looking guy, thinning hair, mutton chops, a serious demeanor.
Mostly he seems to have just spent a lot of time as a diligent student, and then as an extraordinary researcher, and just a lot of hands-on time cutting up bodies.
Jonathan Strauss is a professor of French at Miami University in Ohio. He's written about Bichat's contribution to medicine and his passion for dissection.
The winter of 1800, he opened up 600 cadavers, and he did human beings, and he also did a lot of work on stray dogs, I'm sorry to say.
This guy was not well regarded by French canines, but he was pretty famous in medical circles, even early in his career. And that's for two reasons. The first, he was doing what was at the time pretty novel research on organs and how cells join together to form tissue. And second, Bichat was popular because he did a really nice job explaining his theories.
He's very clear. He's a very clear writer. He has a sort of Mozartian clarity and poise and balance to his writing. People could make sense of him.
And right around the turn of the century, Bichat uses those skills to write a book.
In French, it's Recherche physiologique sur la vie et sur la mort. And in English, Physiological Researches Upon Life and Death.
And in that book, Mary Spires finds what she's been looking for, the origins of the double conk.
Bichat thought that if you got hit in the head, that you would be out of balance. So there was this idea of symmetry.
He spells out this theory that the two halves of the brain, the left brain, the right brain, work in a careful balance. They're partners. And Bishop explains that if one side of the brain is somehow injured, it throws off the functioning of the entire unit. He writes that the two sides, quote, cannot be different in their mode of acting.
He doesn't use this example, but it's sort of like the gears of a machine getting out of alignment. And so instead of complementing each other, they're going to be interfering with each other.
Bishop's law of symmetry therefore held that if you damaged one side of the brain, well, you needed to damage the other side to restore harmony.
So was Bishop coming through with any evidence to support this theory?
My suspicion is that this was something that was just fairly common in terms of ideas, and he was just using evidence that he thought everybody already knew about.
Curiously, for a man so dedicated to science and dissection and proof, Bishop fails to offer any. Instead, he simply writes about how frequently this method of restoring brain function is reported as working. He's just pulling from popular culture, from these anonymous stories and anecdotes. Turns out Bishop isn't the origin of the double conch. He just gets credit for being the first to put the thing down in writing, at least as far as Mary Spires can tell. He was so wrong, though, about how the brain works and what could cure it, I'm not sure we should give him any credit.
Oh, you wouldn't be the first to discredit him. Get in line.
Jonathan Strauss says by the fourth edition of the book, about 20 years after its first publication, his editors had disavowed the entire brain symmetry double conch argument. Science had moved on to other theories about how the brain functioned. But that opens up an interesting question. If the medical establishment was willing to leave the double conch behind in the early 19th century, why won't fiction writers?
I think because it just has such dramatic potential, and it can make your characters do things that they wouldn't normally do. It can put them in situations that they wouldn't normally be in, and we, the audience, can be in on it.
Sally Baxendale is a neuropsychologist at University College London. She's written about amnesia in the movies.
So we know things that the characters don't know. And that combination, I think, is really, really seductive for filmmakers. And it's entertaining. It really works.
And so, to sum up, amnesia is still a medical mystery. It can last a day, a week, or 20 years.
20 years? Well, we'll be too old to be rescued by then.
There must be some cure. Could we try alcohol rubs?
We've got to cure the captain. He's our friend. He's our leader. Besides, he's the only one who can signal those ships.
On the other hand, amnesia isn't hopeless. Anything can happen. Sometimes it'll clear up by itself. Sometimes a blow on the head will snap the victim right out of it again.
Beyond the double conch, Baxendale says it's frustrating to see memory loss so often inaccurately portrayed on screen.
What you find in the movies time and time again is that somebody will get a very nasty bang on the head and have absolutely no difficulties creating new memories, but they'll lose who they are. They'll lose all access to any information from the past, which doesn't make any sense neurologically because we just don't see that in patients.
For the vast majority of people with head injury, she says learning new skills and forming new memories are the harder tasks, not remembering who you are or where you're from. Bishop, of course, isn't around to atone for his mistakes, though he is still hailed in France for his scientific achievements. In fact, he's one of 72 names inscribed on the Eiffel Tower. And the end of his story, well,
whatever happened to Bishop?
He died at a young age, and ironically, probably, we think, due to a head injury.
A cerebral hemorrhage of some sort. I think he was in the School of Medicine. He stumbled on the stairs and fell on the stairs, hit his head, only once, which may have been the problem, and subsequently died.
A single conch at the age of 30, a life cut short well before the credits rolled. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.